All right, hi everybody, and welcome to the test three, test preparation class for the junior and senior high in the ancient history program of History at Our House. We're going to look back on the test prep sheets that you received concerning Greece, Athens, and Sparta in particular, and see how you did and get you ready for the upcoming test. Brief point, just to make sure that I get this out of the way and that it's not lost on you guys. We don't have any classes on Monday, so you have an extra day to do the test, because as the academic calendar indicates, it is Martin Luther King Day on Monday. So classes resume on Tuesday, just to make sure that that point is out there. Let's now go and look at the junior high test preparation sheets. You have a variety of labeled points on your anchor fact timeline of world history, and some of them are indicated, some of them are not. So let's burn through these here. This should be a quite straightforward exercise by this point. Let's go. Number one, Juliet.
We are here. 2016.
Okay, let's have some kind of statement of significance. How would you put that in relation to what we're doing here, Juliet?
Well, this is the most significant because this is where we are. This is our point in history.
Okay, and so what I would do with that is I want to put a little spin on that too. Anybody else want to do the spin job here on how to state this in relation to ancient history, Nemo?
We are here in 2016 AD. This is the world we live in now, and to understand it, we must understand the past.
All right, that's the direction I wanted things to go in. That's the way I wanted it to go. But maybe just a little more, just one word would have made that exactly the way that I wanted. The word ancient. Right? So in other words, to understand where we are now, it's not good enough to study the recent stuff. American history is awesome, right? But it's not the whole story. European history is pretty amazing, but it's not the whole story. The world we live in is this integration of all these stories that are represented here as these various timelines all connected to each other and culminating here where we are. It's the ancient past that we need to study in order to understand where we are. That's the one thing I want to see in the number one to make it a perfect answer. Okay? So, let's go to number two. Same thing. Sophie, please. I think you got a sound issue there. Probably muted on your end or something like that. See what you can do about that. I'll leave you unmuted until you can sort that out. Timothy, go ahead.
Rome falls in circa 476 AD and causes the Dark Ages.
Okay. And that's good. I mean, you know, I wouldn't mark you down for that, but maybe we can also try to give it greater, you know, overall significance. What would you say greater significance is in the context of ancient history, Timothy?
It starts the birth of Europe.
Yeah, which is the end of?
The end of ancient Greece and Rome.
Yeah, and really, in essence, the end of the ancient world. So this is the fall of Rome is the end of the ancient world and the beginning of the modern. Right, so I think that's a really good point to include there. I just realized that I got my sequencing off here. Number five belongs further down than number two. So that's kind of a mistake. I'm going to edit that in the final test so that it looks better. The purple should be longer because Islam begins after Europe, of course. And Russia should be also. I don't know why that happened. So I'll just push these over. But anyway. All right. So that's the significance of 476. Is it's the end of the ancient world. And we are now only connected to it through the Dark Ages and the Renaissance. Okay, that would be the ultimate statement of the significance there. All right, let's do number three. Now added to our timeline, 776 BC. Nemo, go ahead.
The Olympic Games are held at Olympia on the Peloponnese.
Okay, so now we got the fact, but we don't have much of the significance there. So, key event. All right, so, you know, like I said, I'm going to give you guys the points for the fact, but I would love to see you express what is the significance of it. Okay, this is the beginning of Greek history. That would be one way to put it. What would be another way to put it? This is the beginning of the Greek culture that brought us so many of the values that are still alive today. Or something like that. Okay, to understand history, we got to be careful not to end up in the past whenever we're talking about a fact of the past. If we're stuck in the past, we're only halfway done, right? We haven't completed our answer. Okay, so to say this is the beginning of ancient Greek culture, now we've got a connection. Because Greek culture means 508. It means all the stuff that's connected to us. So now we've made the connection. Still a little bit indirect, but we've started to make the connection. All right, let's go on here. Sophie, volume test. Are you there? I see your hand up, but I still don't see your volume working. See if you can recruit, because I've got you unmuted, but I can't hear you. So see if you can recruit some help in the household here, or maybe disconnect and reconnect somehow. You know, let's try to solve this for you. All right, the rest of you guys, number four, 1799 AD. So I started using tick marks here, right, to represent these facts, so you don't have to guess what it is I'm talking about. All right, let's go 1799. We didn't do this recently in class, but we sure did it before. Timothy?
The Rosetta Stone is found, unlocking almost all of Egyptian history.
Okay, right. Reconnecting us. What I would say there is reconnecting us, or actually connecting us once and for all to the history of ancient Egypt that we were fascinated with but could not decipher. Okay, that would be the key to the Rosetta Stone, right? It is to decipher Egyptian, allowing us to decipher Egyptian history. How about that? Rosetta Stone is discovered, becoming the key to deciphering Egyptian history. Okay, number five, circa 622 AD. Nemo, go ahead.
I didn't mean to be sorry.
All right, but you should still be able to answer. What was it?
A very good one. The birth of Islam or the Hijra.
Okay, right. The Hijra of Muhammad gives rise to the birth of Islam. Well, these are very similar, 5 and 2. So, what you guys can do on the off the cuff here. What I said was, this is the end of the ancient world. And Timothy quite rightly added, the beginning of the European world. So, go ahead. Give me the same type of answer with regard to number 5. How would we state that? From now on, it's brown, not purple. So, how would you put that into words? The rise of Islam and the extinction of, Juliet?
Archaic Egypt.
Yeah, not just Egypt. Mesopotamia, Persia, all of the archaic cultures of, all of the cultures of the archaic world. Okay? Being replaced. All the way from Morocco all the way to Indonesia, eventually they're going to get all replaced. So this is a powerful transformation point in history. There really are only two, in a sense, three such transformations in all of history. Isn't that fascinating to see? Right? I mean, basically history, you know, we have this transition here from gray to green. And we have this transition here from purple to brown. These are my colors, you know, that's not the meaning of it. It's just the visualization. And then we have the green to blue. Those are the big ones. The other one is kind of also the injection of the green into everything else. The transformation of every other culture by Western civilization through globalization. But there's not that many of these massive inflection points in history or pivot points or what you could kind of use your whatever word you want to use for them. I mean, they are anchor facts, of course, but they're a very special kind. They represent massive transformations in the cultural framework of the world. Really shocking changes, but there aren't that many of them. So history is not nearly as complicated as a lot of people think it is. There's only really so many super big important facts. And all the rest are really just swamped by those. All right, let's keep going. 1700 AD. Oh my gosh. That's supposed to say BC. And I think you guys already caught me on that one. And I forgot to fix it from last time. That is so silly. All right, I got to write myself a note. And by the time anybody listens to this recording, this will no longer be a problem. I'm gonna fix the file. All right, but Abby, give me this one, please, number six.
Was my hand raised? Because I wasn't so sure about that one.
Well, if you weren't, I mean, why? My question for you would be why? Because if you've already done test two, then you've already answered these questions. This is review now. So it was up to you to go and find the answers to this, right? So I don't think there's a valid excuse for not having this. So, I mean, I get that you don't have it and why, but I don't think it's a very good reason. Nemo?
Is made by the Babylonian Empire Emperor Hammurabi, showing us what archaic society was like.
Very nice, very nice. That's perfect. Okay, and then finally, 2500 AD. So Timothy, that was your joke, huh? When the robots finally take over. Yes, okay. So what's the actual one if it's 2500 BC?
The actual one is the pyramids of Giza were built.
Okay, there we go. Exactly. You know, symbolizing ancient Egypt and inspiring the modern history of the modern study of archaic Egypt. Right? So it's inspiring the study of archaic history in modern times. That would be the ultimate connection. Okay, sorry for the typos. When you catch the typos, it sure would be nice if you would send me an email. Then I might be able to address it before a class like this and fix it up. But as it stands, I'm going to have to do it after the fact. All right, anyway, let's continue. Number eight, how did Greece's mountainous terrain affect its early history? Sophie, is your microphone on?
Can you hear me?
Yes, okay, go ahead.
Okay, because the mountains made it difficult to travel between different communities, each separate village formed into a different small country. Because the citizens of these different city-states were so isolated from the others, they cared more about their individual city-states than the collective larger country of Greece.
Okay, nice, good, right? The mountainous terrain kept the communities isolated from each other. You might have mentioned the point about not providing that environment for an easy environment for unification, but you said it basically. I would give you full points for that answer. You mentioned the crucial point about the city-states and the concept of the Greeks having allegiance to their local communities over the country as such. I mean, the country never really quite existed. I mean, that's just the thing. It was never quite born until modern times. Kind of a surprising thing. Greece is a modern country. It had its War of Independence from 1821 to 29 against a Muslim empire, the Ottoman Empire. And then that's the first time it really became a country. all through its ancient times, and then later on it was ruled by Rome, then it was ruled by the Byzantine Empire, then it was ruled by the Ottoman Empire. It was never a country. Never. Until modern times. Not that it did them much good to unify, because now Greece is a mess. So I don't know. Greece is a place with quite a bumpy history. All right, anyway, let's just move on, because that was a good answer. So number 9, what things did the people of Greece have in common, even though they lived in separate city-states? All right, so this is kind of the other side of the coin. What did they have in common? What, was that a hard question? No, I think it was an easy one. Juliet?
People of Greece had several things in common, even though they lived in separate city-states. All of the Greeks spoke the same language. Also, they practiced the same religion.
Okay, there we go. That's pretty much the basic answer. I think I would be willing to give full marks for that one. I was hoping to get, you know, somebody would say, well, okay, they got the same language, they got the same religion, and consequently they celebrated the Olympic festival to mark their common culture on a periodic basis. I was looking for that last little answer, which is connected to our anchor fact of 776. Okay, so that would be the way to just cap off that answer, that would be perfect. All right, let's go now to Archaic Athens. So this evidently is a longer answer that leaves room for a lot of your storytelling ability here. Who were the Eupatrids of Athens? How did they shape the government of Athens in its early history? And I'm giving you a little bit of a hint here to say elaborating from what to what and how. So given the size of the space available, it's obviously not a short answer version. Cliff, get us started.
The Eupatrids were named the Sons of Noble Fathers. They were a group of nobles in ancient Athens. They helped shape the government of Athens by rebelling against the monarchy, the early monarchy of Athens, which was ruled by a single family called the Medontidae. When they rebelled against them, they implemented an aristocracy allowing other noble families to run for a kingship. However, they had to share power, and they could only remain in charge for 10 years, a decennial kingship.
Okay, so you got the thrust of it here, but you stopped kind of before it was really over. So what you need in your answer, Cliff, to improve it is to treat decennial kingship for what it is. It's not an end point. It's a transitional point, or it's a transition. In other words, the stages here of establishing the full aristocracy was going from decennial kingship to then annual kingship with the presence of the other archons separating the power. That it's at that point the transition is really complete. Okay, so I would want you to include that last segment, because the decennial part was never the end of the story. Okay, let's see a different version of it. Nemo.
The Eupatrid sons of noble fathers were the rich descendants of the Ionian lords that defended Athens against attack during the Dorian invasion. Athens was ruled by a single family, the Medontidae. At the top of this family was a monarch who ruled for life. Eventually, however, the other Eupatrids started... The Eupatrids started to not tolerate being the second best, as they wanted power too. In 753... a revolt occurred, and the other families, the Eupatrids, forced the Medontidae to share its power with them. The kingship was no longer limited to the Medontidae. Every 10 years, a new group of kings was elected. This satisfy the aristocracy for a while, but they wanted new changes. The kingship was reduced to only 1 year. The power was broken up among nine officials called Acherons. Now Athens was an aristocracy, which means rule of the best.
Okay, it's a little too wordy, so you needed to, you got all the points in there, but you spent a little bit too much time, let's say, on each of the separate points. So it would be, I don't know if that really fit into this space or not. It felt like it was longer than it needed to be. So you got all the points, but now, so your challenge then, Nemo, is to shorten the answer and what I would say, essentialize that answer. Right, so we don't need to spend too much time elaborating on the conditions of decennial kingship. It's really all we need about that is that they started out having the kings reduced to 10 years, and then, okay, they moved to annual kingship with archons. By the way, it's archons, just like the word archy, right? So if you need a little bit of a tip on the way to write that, or you know, just to get that word right, we have like in the term mon, and then we have archy, right? And so, or do archy. All right, so the archy part is very much like the term archon. Okay, that is the character. That means a ruler. This is the rule of two, the rule of one. This is a ruler. That will help you in case you're just getting stuck on the pronunciation of that term. Okay? All right, so anyway, that was a good answer as well. And the key, of course, is to get through to the idea that the power has been divided up and by what steps it has been done. Okay, good. Well, let's go. Let's move on to number 11 then. Now, why is the Cylon affair an important episode in the story of Athenian government? And then I gave you a little bit of a hint there. What did it lead to? Timothy.
The Cylon affair was an important episode in the story of Athenian government. Cylon's attempt at taking over during a time when aristocrats were fighting was thwarted by the Athenian soldiers. They did not someone to walk in and take over the government haphazardly. After the attempt, Cylon was exiled, and the Athenian government put stricter laws in place to prevent the incident from ever happening again.
Okay. It would be just nice to name what those laws were and who did it. Would be just a nice way to connect up the narrative there, to complete it. So we're talking about the laws of Draco. Is the second part of the answer in detail. Juliet, go ahead.
The Cylon affair is an important episode in the story of Athenian government because as a result of the ensuing chaos, a man called Draco was given the job of making new laws. He made very harsh laws, but they were effective. It led to crimes being handled in courts organized by the government.
Okay. Right, made harsh laws. It might be also just a good idea to talk about. It's an important episode because it shows us the problem of aristocracy and an attempt in the archaic world to deal with that problem. Draco's laws are like Hammurabi's laws, right? The punishment for most crimes is death. So it ties us, it's a good link to the rest of archaic history. It shows us that the Greeks weren't any different from anybody else. They had the same problems because they were living at the same stage of human development. And it was hard for them to push past that plateau. And here, with the Cylon affair, with the violence within the state and the disorder, and then the harsh or draconian laws, the laws of Draco, right? It shows that, well, they had the same problems and they made the same mistakes as everybody else. It really helps us to appreciate people like Solon and Cleisthenes, who are heroes in terms of forging a better way of life, not only for the Greeks, but because of how great the Greeks were, because they the record of what they did was passed on to us, we get to live better lives. So that's the full significance of the Cylon and Draco episodes in history, is it shows us what it's like to be stuck. The Greeks were stuck too. They were stuck all the way to Cleisthenes. I mean, Solon tried to help, but it wasn't a complete solution, and it was making life better, but, you know, that's what it was like to be stuck on the Archaic Plateau. No fun. Okay, number 12. What is the problem of faction, as described by James Madison? How did Cleisthenes address this problem in his own time? Sophie.
James Madison stated in Federalist No. 10 that a faction is a group that wants to harm the rights of another. He said that unless people accept individual rights, politics will never be anything more than faction. Cleisthenes introduced the idea of commoners having a say in political matters instead of only the aristocratic families. The aristocrats and the commoners were forced to work together, and elections chose officials, not what family you were born into.
Okay, nice. So it feels like it's missing just a little description of how the things that Cleisthenes is doing are related to the problem of faction. I think you're missing that last abstract statement that's required, because you've got it, and it's obvious that you've got it, but you didn't say like something on this order. Cleisthenes wanted to solve this problem of faction by getting the aristocratic and commoners, the factions of the aristocrats and the commoners, to work together. So that would be the way to fuse that answer a little bit more solidly, by using that abstraction of faction in the second part of your answer, including it a little bit more. But you got the essence. Okay, this is really, really crucial. This is really the essence. And it's so interesting how brilliant the Founding Fathers were in analyzing these things. They're the ones that help us to understand what archaic life was and how incredible their concept of individual rights was as the solution to that problem. Nowadays, thinking is nowhere near as clear. We are going back to, increasingly, if I can measure the trends in the culture well enough, and I think I can, we are back. Factionalism is back. So whether it's racial factions or gender-based factions or all kinds of others, religious ones, national ones, the whole character of modern politics is factional. So that means that we have, and it's historians' fault, because they failed in their sacred responsibility to explain to everybody how important this is. And so hopefully you are listening and thinking about it, and you will have this ability to interpret what's going on around you. And maybe Federalist number 10 will be a part of how you think and communicate about it. If it can be, that's a really good thing. It will be, you will better understand all the conflicts that you see in the society, and hopefully be able to contribute towards some better answers than the ones that we're getting put forward, because we're not seeing some good answers from any side. So that's a big one. That's a big one. And it's so amazing. That's what we call a universal theme in human politics. It doesn't matter where you look. James Madison was absolutely right, spot on. Factionalism is just that basic conflict in human politics, and the only solution, there is only one, the only solution is of individual rights. And it's really sad that American history, you know, that it wasn't that America was founded from the context that it was, because that has allowed a lot of really petty people to look back on it and accuse the founding fathers of hypocrisy and factionalism themselves, because they had slaves and they had that heritage of factionalism inherited from Europe, and they couldn't shrug off the whole thing. And consequently, now in modern society, people look back and they feel justified in taking pot shots at the greatest politicians in the history of mankind just because they couldn't solve all the problems, which is really sad. So, anyway, Cleisthenes is one of the heroes in the story. James Madison is another one. It's a good idea to connect them in our minds. All right, let's keep going. Archaic Sparta, very peculiar society, definitely one that embraced factionalism rather than rejected it. So, in what ways was the Spartan government aristocratic? I might have said also, in what ways was it not, but maybe that would have been too much. Timothy, go ahead.
Okay, the Spartan government had some aristocratic traits. You did have aristocrats called Spartiati, for one. There were also two kings, which is aristocratic because you are sharing the power. These two kings were also monitored by five ephors that kept the kings in check. The power was spread across the different ranks in Spartan government, and while it isn't an aristocracy, it does have similarities to an aristocracy.
All right, nice. Right, I like the expression you use, keep the kings in check. It's just like the game of chess, right? I don't know if you play chess, but that expression, checks and balances, keeping the king in check, I mean, that's, you know, that all goes together. Sometimes we use expressions like that unconsciously, but it's just great. It's a sign, in a sense, that you're educated, that you use good expressions where they fit. So, good job. Okay, that's the essence of it. And so let's continue on, though, of course, because the Spartan government was not an aristocracy because of what? Well, let's look at 14. What were the stages of the life of the Spartan warrior, Nemo?
Spartan warriors were raised by their mother until age 7. Then they are taken from their families and put in a harsh communal public school at age 20. Where they learned physical education, music, and poetry. At age 20, Sparta male graduated. He then joined a platoon of Spartan soldiers. These men stayed in their platoon for most of the time for the next 10 years. After this, he would be allowed to participate in the making of laws for Sparta. If he survived for 30 more years, he might be elected as an ephor or another high rank serving the kings and ephors.
Mm-hmm. Okay, nicely done. I think you probably just made an inadvertent error. You said stayed at home until they were 20, and then you said, and then they graduated after 20. So I think that was just, you probably just got those mixed up. Right, but just in case, right, they stayed home until they were 7, and then went off, as you said. And all right, so that was great. Okay, let's keep going here. Finish up. What was the Spartan view of the value of the life of the individual? What kind of government did they create reflecting this view, Juliet?
The Spartan view of the value of the life of an individual was that they should live to serve the government. They believed everyone should sacrifice their life for the common good. This type of government they created was an archaic form of communism.
Okay, nice. I mean, that is the heart of it right there. So the individual life has no intrinsic value. That would be maybe perhaps one way to express the matter. So in other words, you as an individual don't count for anything. So you've got to have that premise of the individual human life being valuable, which we call individualism, and then in order to have a free government. The Athenians definitely were individualists. And then you have the broader premise, human life, which we call humanism, or the value of that is expressed through humanism, and then the individual life through individualism, and then you get some of these special developments. And the Spartans, of course, did not think that way. They did not think that the individual matters. They thought that only the city and the walls matter, and the only way you've got that is by collective sacrifice. And everybody has to pull together, and thus the only justification for the individual is his service to the collective. And that we call the opposite of individualism is collectivism. And communism is a kind of it. Communism is that kind of collectivism that says we're gonna organize the society around a central government, and these people who are most dedicated to that, and Nemo just talked about it in the life of a Spartan, if you prove your dedication in your service to the state for your entire life, then you reach the top and you become the one who has power over the ones who have power over everybody else, and everybody else basically spends their whole time justifying their lives in terms of the system that you are in charge of. That's called communism. Nemo, go ahead.
Spartans did not respect... Oh, did someone already answer this?
Yeah, that's fine, but yeah, more is better.
Oh, all right. Spartans did not respect any person's life as an individual. Every stage of a Spartan's life from their birth was controlled by the government or the state. The Spartan government functioned according to a set of laws to which every government agent, including the king, swore their allegiance. But this did not make Sparta a republic or even a constitutional monarchy. Instead, it was a system of government in which the individual must live for the state, which controlled his life, in the name of common good, which is known as communism.
Okay, perfect. Perfect answer. Okay, excellent. Cliff?
I said that the Spartan view of life was that individuals had no value but to serve the government. The Spartan government had essences of a duarchy, aristocracy, and a constitutional monarchy. However, the most accurate description of their government was communism.
Okay, I would modify that just a little bit. I would say the Spartan government had elements of duarchy, aristocracy, and what was the other one that you said, but I wouldn't use the word essences, okay? Because in terms of, as a form of government, it's only going to have one. There's only one. And that's the basis for the term. Otherwise, we would be able to just use whatever term that we want. If there's more than one essence, then we could use any term that we want, basically. There's only one. It has multiple elements, but one of them is central, or another word would be one of them is fundamental. One of them is what it gives all of the rest their true and full character. And that is the basic premise, which is built into the structure of the system, the framework of the system, which is service to the state and in the name of the common good. And that's why communism is the best term. Okay, so, all right, those are good. Those are good. Good discussion and a very worthwhile topic. A couple of things to just icing on the cake. What is the word for something that lasts 10 years, like the kingship in Athens, Nemo?
Decennial.
Decennial, okay. Number 17, what was the name of the fighting unit involved? Heavily armed soldiers that made commoners more important. Where are all the answers? Juliet.
Phalanx.
Phalanx, okay. And then 18, what Greek lawmaker made especially harsh laws? Cliff?
Draco.
Draco, exactly. Draconian laws. Okay, excellent. Good answers, good basis for discussion. And so hopefully that serves you well. And so when the recordings are posted today of today's lecture, you will also get the test. And we don't have class on Monday, so you get an extra day to do it if you want to take advantage of that. But looks like you guys are in pretty good shape. Last questions or comments? Otherwise, oh, Keen, go ahead.
I did have one. Regarding Sparta, what classes were able to follow the pattern of life that we talked about? Because the slaves obviously weren't. What about the commoners?
No, and the commoners neither. So they're on the periphery. So if you remember we talked briefly about the wars of Sparta and the creation of the Peloponnesian League. So when the Spartans conquered their neighbors Messenia, then what they did was they put Messenia into a tributary status. And those were your commoners. So they're not quite, they don't have Spartans walking around in their town all the time. They're commoners, they're not slaves. They've got their own land, but they exist as a tributary city-state. And thus, they also have no participation in politics. And they, in essence, have no rights either. But they get to live on their own farms, in their own circumstances, within limits, right? But unlike the slaves, who would be used to work the land of Sparta, those commoners, those periakoi of tributary states, did get to kind of live on a day-to-day basis like commoners elsewhere. But ultimately, they are completely disposable. So if Sparta wants to go to war, then they're going to come and they're going to recruit all the commoners and put them in the front lines and make them take the brunt of a lot of fighting at first and really treat them like fodder and as disposable human beings. And they are completely cut off from all politics, just like the slaves. So the only thing that they've got that's any better is just that day-to-day life. They have the illusion, in a sense, although perhaps you could say it's real. I mean, on a day-to-day basis, they go through their days without that constant overwatch. But it's there in the overall framework. Okay? All right. Excellent. Thank you, everybody. Good luck on the test. Have a good weekend. Talk to you Tuesday.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.